I'll say to you, Craig.
Thank you. Good morning. In this session, we're going to be asking you about some specific topics about the board's goodwill and impairment project. So as a reminder, the board published the discussion paper, Business Combinations, Disclosures, Goodwill and Impairment last year. And this year, the board has been firstly discussing the feedback it received on the discussion paper and has begun to make some tentative decisions as part of its reconsiderations of its preliminary views. The preliminary views in the discussion paper covered improving disclosures about business combinations and the accounting for goodwill and some other aspects of business combinations. In September this year, the board decided to prioritise an analysis of feedback on firstly, disclosures about business combinations, and secondly, some specific aspects of the debate as to whether to retain the impairment-only model for goodwill or whether to reintroduce amortisation. And so we have three questions for you today, and I'm going to introduce the first of those three questions, which is about disclosures on business combinations. And after we've discussed that question, I'm going to pass to my colleague Tim, who's going to introduce the remaining two questions, being about the usefulness of a management estimated life of goodwill and conversions with US GAAP. So on the first topic, the board's preliminary view to improve information about the subsequent performance of business combinations. Preliminary view uses the concept of the entity's chief operating decision maker to identify the business combinations that a company would need to provide information for. So applying the board's preliminary view, an entity would need to disclose the information that the CODM is monitoring to assess whether the business combination is meeting the CODM's objective for that particular acquisition. And the board identified a number of potential benefits of using the CODM in that way, including that it might strike a useful balance between the benefits and costs of preparing that information, because the board expects that the entity's CODM is going to be looking at the most important information about the most important acquisitions. However, some respondents to the discussion paper raised concerns that using the CODM in this way could result in users missing out on material information about business combinations. And so the first question that we have for CMAC members is on slide 11, and we are asking about whether you need information of the subsequent performance of business combinations for all acquisitions for which you currently receive information about in the financial statements, or whether there's some subset of business combinations for which you need such information. And if there is a subset, we'd like you to describe what that subset is. And so I'm happy to hand over to CMAC members now to discuss that first question.
Thanks, Craig. Welcome views on that first question around the relevant set of business combinations. Who would like to get started? Deirdre, thank you.
Hi, just with regards to, just to make sure I'm understanding this correctly, so you're wondering if once we receive disclosure, we'll say in the first financial period, that we need disclosure subsequently with regards to how that acquisition is tracking, is that what you mean?
In theory, yes. So the board's preliminary view covers both the year of acquisition in terms of requiring companies to disclose the strategic rationale, the objective, and the metrics that management intend to use to measure the success, and then subsequent years to basically report what those metrics actually are to allow you to determine whether it was a success or not.
Yeah. So definitely, I suppose when I was looking at it, the first thing that sprung to mind is that we don't tend to get excessive information. I think that was mentioned somewhere in the presentation. And the disclosure we get at the moment would typically be only for material acquisitions. Obviously, that definition of materiality will depend on the entity you're looking at. I have a bit of a financial, I'm more from the financial sector, so I would often think about the consumption of regulatory capital, but the materiality could be to do with the market capitalization, the business impact in terms of operating profit mix or revenue mix. But I suppose from a get-go, we don't get excessive information technically on day one. But what would be is vital for us is that we do continue to get the disclosure in subsequent years, so as we can determine how effective that company was with regards to allocating capital in the first instance. Was it a success? And I suppose that is the challenge we face often, that the disclosure kind of diminishes with the passing of time. And that passage of time might be just 6 months, which is very short, particularly if it has been significant. And for us, the other challenge can be if it is a serial acquirer. And what I mean by that is not necessarily doing material acquisitions, but a string of bolt-on acquisitions, the accumulation effect of which can be substantial. Again, that can be very difficult for us to try and determine how effective management are with regards to being the stewards of capital again. So I'm not sure how your preparers, I'm sure that would be quite challenging, but if there was some way to, particularly for a serial acquirer, to improve the disclosure so as we could see over a period of time how effective it has been. They're kind of my initial thoughts.
Thanks, Deirdre. Matthias?
Yes, thanks. Can you hear me?
We can, thank you.
Yeah, perfect. Hi to everybody. I fully agree with Deirdre here in these points. One of the points she mentioned, I would just put under the umbrella term stewardship with a serial acquirer. I think this gets more and more important to really understand whether the management has done a good acquisition and that we can track this and understand that capital allocation, or whether capital allocation is done in a good way. And that's why basically I'm in favor of a lot of performance information, subsequent performance information. And the second point is also, I think it disciplines down management if they have to put subsequent performance information, because it's perhaps easy to name a couple of great goals for an acquisition, and if you do not have to present any consequences of this or any subsequent performances, management might be tempted to be a bit bigger in its estimate. But I think it's necessary if you require management, which is a good idea, to talk more about the goals and the intentions of such a transaction, then you should also track it and allow investors to track it. So from my point, I would like to have subsequent performance information about all business combinations here in the financial statements.
Thanks, Matthias. Joel?
Yes, so a lot of what I would say, I think, has been mentioned already by Matthias and Deirdre, but completely agree. All combinations, I think, would be very useful from the perspective of analysts. I think what we tend to do is try to anticipate impairments and anticipate a lot of the future goodwill the balance sheet will be, and having that information on a regular basis, I think, will be very useful. Because, and I think in general, analysts tend to do a reasonable job at it with not a lot of precision, but definitely the anticipation already happens. This would simply be giving more tools so that anticipation is done in a more precise way. So I think it would be very useful.
Thanks, Joe. Terence, you had a question.
Thanks, Nick. I just want to go back to the actual question. So is it the choice of either getting information for all disclosed acquisitions, getting subsequent performance information for all disclosed acquisitions versus a subset of those disclosed acquisitions? So do all those disclosed acquisitions have to pass that materiality threshold
So then, in theory, just now, everything for which information is disclosed is material.
Yeah.
And entities have made that assessment that that's material information.
Yeah, if those are the two buckets, then I would definitely fall into that disclose everything. If it's a material acquisition that has already been disclosed, then as an investor, yeah, I'd want information on that rather than a subset of that material bucket. Then, just to reiterate Deirdre's point and a few others have chipped in, yeah, particularly when it comes to serial acquirers and whenever they're, you know, spending significant sums of capital on smallish bolt-on transactions, it's very difficult to get a sense as to, you know, things like the ROIC on those on that M&A when you just don't get any information. So if there was a way to think in terms of looking at the subsequent performance, both on an individual basis where it's material, but also at a bigger picture where individually it's not material, but in aggregate it's material, that would be helpful as well.
Okay. Thanks, Terence. Patron? Hi, Bertrand, we can't hear you at the moment.
I had a problem with my mouse. It's okay, thank you. Yes, only some few comments and that are consistent with what have been said. But first of all, I would like to say that acquisitions often are merged within the entities, within the larger entity, and it may be a problem or an issue to follow the performance of such acquisition where all the departments are split within the company. The second point is about the reference to the chief operating decision makers. And I understand that in the proposal, it would be key to understand the performance of an acquisition. But from our point of view, if the CODM is not strong enough to get or to present such information, we may lack the needed information to understand the performance of the acquisition. And finally, with the materiality, I would say that, of course, we don't want to be overloaded with information. And as has been said, the materiality, the size of the acquisition, the issue of the serial acquirers that may buy a small and very large number of small companies. But also it is interesting to understand the performance of even small acquisitions if these acquisitions are present on new market or new location. And in that case, it's interesting to understand how this acquisition is performing over the following years. So these are my comments.
Thanks, Matron. Let's go to James next.
Yes, my comment follows on from Bertrand. I do observe that many acquisitions involve legal entities being dismantled, having business units from different entities transferred into the acquirer's existing legal entities if they're going to work well. So I have a lot of sympathy for the preparers. This looks like quite burdensome and could also be very information overload. It could drive information overload for us. I suspect that one of the better ways to do this could be through IAS 14. So an enhancement of IAS 14 where the impact of acquisitions on each of the business segments in terms of whether it's volume or revenue or and costs and earnings has to be in the MD&A or has to be in the footnotes, so actually in the footnotes relating to segment reporting. That I suspect might be a better way to determine, you know, how to value, because at the end of the day, especially with serial acquirers, it just seems to be a very difficult thing to get that this one acquisition may added value I mean, it's something you can do over time with various efficiency ratios, return on capital, ROE, etc., to find that an acquisition strategy works. But to sort of say pinpoint this one acquisition, it just seems a lot of work for everyone to try and get to that answer otherwise.
Thanks, James. Anthony. Anthony, you're on mute, I believe.
Can you hear me now?
We can, thank you.
Sorry. I'll echo that comment just quickly before I get started with my details, is regarding the burdensome point, and which leads to the comment, which leads to the materiality. And I know materiality is defined within IFRS, but you know, in Canada, we have a business acquisition report requirement that companies are required to disclose if the transaction is above a certain threshold of revenue, market cap, or income impact. And what we find is companies find lots of ways to make exceptions to providing the disclosure. So being more very explicit on this situation will be very helpful. And then when you make an acquisition, you're right, tracking it can be very difficult because it becomes integrated. So I think that I strongly agree that providing information is great, but it's probably going to get into MPM type metrics, which are outside of the financial statements, things like organic growth, et cetera. So maybe you want to provide some examples of types of disclosures that you would like to see, or types of metrics that you would like to see. In which case, I would strongly say things like organic growth and or margins, the key metrics the key performance metrics that have been impacted by the acquisition. The other thing is at time zero, when the acquisition is made, the purchase price adjustments really, in my mind, set the tone set the tone of what the financial statements will look like going forward. That companies can spring load their working capital, can make adjustments to valuations of various assets. I could go through lots of examples. But I find that the disclosure of the purchase price adjustments often may not be there. And if I can run my own projections, if I can see what the purchase price adjustments are. So I think emphasis should be put there. And then lastly, with your comment, the UDM. So we're all familiar with the segmented disclosure, and I think similarly we use a similar framework to determine how the disclosure, the segments should be determined. And yet I find that there's not too many management teams that would run their business looking at the segmented disclosure that's provided to us as users. So we have to be, that sounds nice on paper, I think, but you have to actually say, again, provide examples of what disclosure you're looking for, specifically performance metrics. Otherwise, I think the UDM will metric sort of won't provide us with what we are going to actually need. Those are my comments.
Great. Thanks, Anthony. Koi?
Thank you. I agree with DP's proposal. When considering disclosure of subsequent performance information, the impact on consolidated earnings differs according to the size of company being acquired. In addition, impact on consolidated earnings post-acquisition can change significantly in the event of an acquisition of a rapidly growing company. I think it would be difficult to set threshold for the extent of disclosures in accounting standard. So I think judgment by the CODM as proposal in the discussion paper would be reasonable.
So at the moment, thanks, Koi. Just to be clear, at the moment, it's not the judgment of the CODM, it's the information that's provided to the CODM was the proposal in the discussion paper. But I guess there's an interrelationship between those things, of course. Thanks, Corey.
Jeremy.
So it's probably echoing some of the previous points, but I'm thinking of a situation where a company is consolidating in a fragmented industry. So it may have a large market share and it's buying lots of small companies with tiny market shares. And there's the sense of aggregate materiality of with respect to capital allocation being very high, and they're buying lots of similar companies in nature. So there is a lack of information on these companies. So if there could be this subset of similar small acquisitions that are material in aggregate, that would be very helpful. And on the comments of what performance information would be helpful, I accept that over time when the businesses become integrated, it's difficult to separate out as time goes on. But there'll be some simple non-financial metrics that would be very helpful, such as the number of people that were transferred from the organization being acquired, how many remain in the organization, the wider organization, after 1, 2, 3 years, let's say. I think that would be very helpful information to have. Thank you.
Great, Jeremy. So I don't think in terms of the proposals, well, I know that were included in the exposure draft, it wasn't the intention that the board would specify particular items of information that would be required, but instead for companies to say what the metrics they would use to measure subsequent performance. But Craig, this issue about aggregation of a small number of transactions, there's already some language around that in IFRS 3 at the moment, isn't there?
There is, okay. In IFRS 3 for general materiality.
Right, okay, yeah. Okay, thank you. Oliver, go to you next.
Hi, yes, can you hear me?
Yes, thanks, Oliver.
Okay, great, yeah. I pretty much agree with everything that's been said in terms of views. I think from a user viewpoint, I would add that it is an absolute focus point of you know, I think a lot of users, and an analysis is getting done on it. And so, look, anything that can improve this analysis and the efficiency of it and the accuracy of it, I think is absolutely welcome. I don't know if it's a function of where we are in the market cycle but you know, it seems increasingly, you know, capital allocation into acquisition is, again, I've no data behind this, but it seems to be cropping up across my, you know, desks every day. And whether it's, you know, significant strategic acquisitions or it's the material aggregation point that Jeremy made, which I think is a really interesting point. I would say, I mean, the question to me would be, you know, timeframes. You know, what timeframes are we talking about here? I think, you know, again, from a user point of view, when looking at these acquisitions, I mean, again, echoing what's been said, we're looking, you know, at ultimately the return on capital that's being generated on the capital that's spent on the acquisition and the assets bought, tangible or intangible, and then we're looking at the growth of that as well. And so, you know, there's talk thinking about that from a discrete point of view. And that is absolutely, you know, anything we can get of that is really interesting. But again, just again echoing stuff, I think the reality is within a business, those things get integrated either officially or it, you know, whether it's, for example, a company buys assets and a distribution system, but what it does is it layers it on its own products through that distribution system. So, you know, how do we think about that? Or if a company just buys a piece of technology, so there are challenges, which everyone said, but the bottom line is I think users are looking at these things, they're analyzing it, and I think more information would be absolutely helpful because there's not a lot at the moment when you go beyond certain time frames. Thanks. Maybe one thing, sorry, I think from, again, just to be from my point of view, I think it's such an interesting and important topic, but the types of metrics we're thinking about here would be interesting to see. But I think you just answered that actually it's more that's incumbent on what do the management teams and operate, you know, chief decision makers think are important, which is fair enough as well.
Yeah, and that's exactly the point I was just going to make, because certainly what was in the, discussion paper, rather, wasn't it, that actually the board wouldn't specify metrics, but it'd be up to the companies or the metrics that the chief operating decision maker used, for the very reason that you said, that, you know, you may acquire a technology which the metric you may use there may be different from another company that you acquire, and to provide provision for that. Craig, is there anything you'd like to sum up or any other questions that you'd like to follow up with CMAP members?
I think what I heard is a lot of people are more concerned about using materiality rather than necessarily CVM. I did hear a lot of discussion about integration, and I guess one of the benefits of using the CODM and making them define these metrics is that they could be using integrated numbers if that's how the CODM is measuring it. I was to sum up in terms of another thing to pick up. It was the aggregation of the material. Yeah. Business combinations was the other thing.
Okay, great. Thanks, Tim. Can we move to the second question then?
Yes. Okay. So, as Craig mentioned earlier, the board's also investigating a couple of specific topics in relation to the amortization of goodwill. And it's doing this to help inform its future decision on whether to reintroduce amortization of goodwill, or, as per its preliminary view in the discussion paper, retain the impairment-only model. Feedback on these topics, along with an understanding of what the disclosure package might look like once the concerns raised by respondents to the discussion paper have been considered, will help the board as it decides the subsequent accounting for goodwill. Now, one of those topics is whether a reliable useful life of acquired goodwill can be estimated and whether that would provide investors with useful information. The feedback on the discussion paper whether a reliable estimate can be made was more mixed than it was in 2004 when the board had decided to require an impairment-only model for the subsequent accounting for goodwill. So the questions for CMAC members on this second topic are on slide 16, and they'll help the board understand whether the information from a useful life that's estimated by management is useful, and why this information is useful, and whether the information would compensate for any information lost from the current impairment-only model if an amortization model, albeit with an impairment test, was reintroduced. So I'd like to open the floor up to CMAC members now for discussion, please.
Thanks. Thanks, Tim. Who would like to kick us off on this one? Larissa, you have a question.
I do, because I feel very strongly about goodwill. The question is, I understand the challenges the board has around estimating a useful life for the goodwill, but how do they differentiate between the value of keeping the goodwill on the balance sheet and not recognizing internally generated goodwill that comes with organic brand definition, organic brand growth?
Well, I mean, internally generated goodwill, you know, in accordance with the standards, is not allowed to be recognised. And you know, one of the arguments that people give for in support of amortisation is that without it, it allows internally generated goodwill to be recognised almost like through the back door, as it were. So it's certainly something in terms of this topic that the board, you know, is considering as one of the arguments as to why amortization might be reintroduced, or whether it's a strong enough argument, in that favour. So, I mean, it's something that's part of the discussion.
As a user, I find it very difficult to distinguish between when you have companies that grow a lot organically versus companies that grow by way of acquisition, because you have that inherent disconnect in the financials. We can adjust for it by doing book values ex goodwill, but personally, I'm a big proponent of the argument for amortization. So if you need anybody in that camp with strong views, happy to contribute.
Thank you, Larissa. other views? Jeremy, you have a comment.
A comment. So it's not a helpful answer to the question, but I just wanted to say how I thought about goodwill almost in three different ways. So there's one part should be amortized, I think, one part should be written off immediately, and one part should be tested for impairments. And the mixture of these three parts varies on a case-by-case basis. So in terms of thinking about if goodwill represents mainly synergies, then I think it's reasonable to amortize it over the expected life of the synergies with the benefit. If it's mainly relating to established processes and the establishment of a good business, that's probably a permanent asset, and that should be tested for impairment. And then I suppose the final part of goodwill I think about is how much the company may have overpaid. And that should be written off immediately. It's not an asset for the business. It's not relevant for subsequent performance. But the question I pose back is that the split between those three different elements is different for every company. Therefore, it's very hard to answer the question, is it A or B? I think it's kind of all three. So I'm sorry,
Thanks, Jeremy.
A confusing answer. Okay.
So that approach to goodwill has been discussed from time to time, breaking up goodwill into its underlying components. I think in practice it's very hard to do, actually, and to write standards around that. And so we're still left with, as I understand theoretically where you come from that perspective, but I think practically I don't think we see legs in that route, so that's fair to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that has been, as you say, has been considered before, and it was considered much earlier as well when IFRS 3 was being developed, and whether a sort of discernible components approach could be taken. And I think the view is that it is very complex and would be very subjective to be able to identify the different components.
Thanks, Anthony. Let's go to you next. Still not hearing you, Anthony.
Sorry.
How long have we been doing virtual?
No, thanks. You know what? It doesn't show me on my face that I'm mute on this system. So, was there intended to be a live meeting today? No, or there was?
No. You're good. Yeah.
Okay, because I see you guys together. That would be cool. All right. So I have very strong views that goodwill should not be amortized. Very strong, for a number of reasons. First and foremost, we were there before. I lived through the dot-com bubble, and analysts did one very simple thing. They just crossed it out, and they moved on. And we... had, if you want, why don't we just go back to pooling of interests, because that works well, and we can just, you know, just make the two companies as though they were together forever. I mean, that was a great idea, and you can see, you know, what happened thereafter with financial reporting. So if you think about what the problem is, the goodwill, you know, and I like that idea of separating into three, that's very interesting, but the problem is it's very subjective. So because something is too subjective, why don't we just, by having it just be an impairment, it takes away the subjectivity. It just says, you know what, we're going to leave it over there. You think management won't tell you they overpaid. Why would they do that? And the investor is going to look at it and decide what lifespan they want to give to it, assess whether they think it should be impaired or not, because they can look at the metrics that are provided by the company, especially if we get better information regarding acquisitions. That'll help me assess whether I think that goodwill should be impaired or not. Just a straight line amortization, that seems very basic, given that society, that we all know businesses erode, perhaps not in a straight line, but not even actually in a declining balance, but could, you know, face a shock this year, and all of a sudden that impairment, there could be an even greater amortization in any one given year or two. So I don't see how this helps anything. And if you look at, if you want to say, well, so I can compare an internally generated to a externally generated, well, an internally generated doesn't have any impact of amortization, because there didn't have any costs, and the one that I bought, I'm going to add all this amortization. So anyway, I don't see how this helps. That's my view.
Okay, that's very, very clear. So not a fan of management's estimate of the useful life of amortization on that basis, we'll say. Matthias, let's hear from you next, please.
Yeah, thanks. To be honest, I'm quite split, and what Jeremy said speaks from my accounting heart. So it really depends. But if I have to name a tendency, I would be pro amortization. for the simple reason that I think goodwill is always a wasting asset. I mean, everything we see is somehow supported. You mentioned it before, is stabilized by internal goodwill. The original goodwill, or the goodwill that was brought on the balance sheet, will, if it's not stabilized, somehow disappear over time. I also see the big problem in determining here an amortization period or a useful life. I'm doing a lot of valuations of intangibles for totally different reasons, and I always have this huge problem to determine a useful life. First point. Second point, what I was also said before here, the question, how does a goodwill develop over the useful life? Is it really a straight line depreciation? Is also a very good point. I mean, if we have the amortization and impairment model, at least we can say, hey, if the goodwill loses value faster, then we can still impair it. Into the other direction, this would not work. Perhaps also what has been mentioned, the comparison of organically growing companies and non-organically growing companies would be easier also from the profit and loss statement if we have some sort of an amortization. And still the comment from before on stewardship, this would also help perhaps if you have amortization, because in an impairment only environment it's really tricky to see the consequences in the profit and loss statement. But it's not, if I have brought now a couple of arguments pro amortization, it's not that I'm 100% sure whether this is the best way, but tendency is towards rather amortization.
Okay, thank you. Neely, did you have a question?
I did. If others would like to speak first, I'm happy to wait.
Okay. We'll come back to you then. Let's go to Joel next.
Hi. I think Jeremy already put it much better than I can. I think there are parts of goodwill that surely deserved to be amortized, but I think that split, as you said, Nick, is quite difficult to do and very subjective. So I'm very anti-amortization as well. I think we've been here before, and as Anthony said, and I wouldn't like to see going back. And I would just add that I think question one that we just discussed and this question two, in a lot of ways, they are attacking the same problem. And I think question one, providing more information about the success or failure and the performance of that acquisition, is a much better way of attacking the same problem than just forcing amortization on every single bit of goodwill that you have on the balance sheet.
Thanks, Joel. Bertram, let's go to you next.
Yes, some comments. I agree that amortization and impairment model, so both is the right answer. The value added, and I and made a reference to the page 16, is that it provides value added. With respect to the useful life of the goodwill, I think that providing a goodwill life is not a major problem as compared to the useful life of some intangible assets or some assets, in particular some new assets in some companies. And it may provide also some information with regard to what to expect from the goodwill and the duration of the goodwill by when the company is acquiring another one. So I think it is, from this point of view, it can be very useful. So it's provide information. The second point is also that, as it stated in some page in the document you provided, you have to match the extra revenue and the extra costs with the goodwill. And for example, when you pay twice the price of a company or more from a company, you have to reflect the extra price in something in the goodwill, and you have to amortize it of the expected income. So I think it's the subsequent profit, extra revenue and extra cost is better reflecting the performance of the company. And I do not expect to have too much loss from the amortization and expense and impairment model. Because with the impairment-only model, we have seen and we have discussed this numerous times, there is a too little, too late issue. And I don't expect at this time, yes, but that we will we can correct this issue. And anyway, having the model will still incur the impairment when the metrics or the information you have will drive the company to impair the assets. But anyway, my feeling is that it's better to have the performance of a company reflecting the extra revenue and the extra cost, including the goodwill consumption, and it's the value added.
So you see that information about the useful life of goodwill by default then does add value, and you're not in the camp of adding back that amortization charge.
No. I don't add it back. But anyway, maybe we can discuss this later. Any analyst can make its own modelization and all model and all analysis. But we will need, of course, to have the information about goodwill amortization somewhere, and we will add more information about goodwill. That for how long it is, for how long we have this goodwill in the balance sheet, and so on. But I think that to assess the performance of the company, it's a part of the goodwill as of the amortization expense, as when we buy assets or when we buy intangible assets. We don't add back the amortization of intangible assets, so this is the issue. But if an investor or analyst has a different view, of course he can do it, but this is not my point of view.
Thanks, Bertram. So I'm just going to go to Anthony next, because he has a question.
Paul.
Anthony, do you want to ask your question?
Yes, I had a quick question. Perhaps it might help color our discussion. I notice in the slides going forward, you have the points about the divergence that seems to be taking place to U.S. GAAP. I think this is a very important, I believe extremely important, I would make the comment that we don't diverge. Now, of course, I'm biased because our largest capital partner, trading partner, Lifeblood, comes from the U.S., given that we're Canadian. But companies will, that's going to cause a huge problem of comparability. And so I would love to understand, what's FASB thinking that they want to go back to amortization? What's the logic and the reasoning that they use?
Okay. Let's park that there for a moment, because we'll come back to that, and let's even get FASB on the phone. We will come back to that. Let's not forget that. So let's go to Koi next.
Thank you. I support amortization and impairment model. I think the useful life estimated by management is important information for investors. On the other hand, I cannot say with certainty that the amortization expense itself is useful. But the same applies to impairment losses. This is because goodwill is a residue. Amortization versus impairment is merely a question of when this residual is expensed. And I do not believe usefulness is enhanced by expensing at any particular timing. First, I would like to comment the usefulness of management estimate of the useful life of goodwill. When acquiring another company, management is likely making the decision to invest after considering how many years will be needed to liquidate the investment. Accordingly, management estimate of the useful life of goodwill should be close to the estimated time horizon for recuperating the investment when making the decision to investment. As a result, the estimated useful life of goodwill can be a window onto management thinking regarding the investment. In the event that the company recognizes impairment losses during this estimated useful life, it is possible to infer that business activity have not progressed according to initial plans and that investment has been a failure. In the case of impairment loss model, if impairment losses are recognized several decades after acquisition, in other words, well after the time horizon that management initially estimate would be needed to recoup the investment has finished, it is likely that neither management nor investors will recognize the investment as a failure. With regard to the final question, investors that have been performing an analysis using profit before amortization of goodwill may be inconvenienced if goodwill amortization is reintroduced. I therefore propose including the cumulative amount of goodwill amortization in the footnote to the financial statement. I should be possible to perform an analysis as before using this additional note. In any case, I believe that the question of whether to use profit before goodwill amortization or after goodwill amortization is an issue of how to apply corporate value. That's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Koi. So if I understand correctly, part of your response in terms of that disclosure that you're suggesting is to help users deal with it the way that they'd like to deal with it themselves individually. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, I think that's my understanding. Okay, thank you. James, hear from you next, please.
Yes. Now, of course, we were first warned, I think now 2 years ago, that this was going to be back on the agenda. And I seem to remember that a lot of the drive came from those on the board who represented countries where goodwill was amortization was tax deductible. Maybe I misunderstood that, but I got that impression. I'm not sure if my answer is going to be helpful at all, but I don't think anyone's really been able to give helpful answers, to be honest, to the actual question there. I actually wanted I wasn't sure if my comment is for question two or question three. I mean, like Anthony, I totally disregard goodwill. I think it is some of it involves concepts that I find absurd and similar to putting angels on seeing how many angels you can fit onto the top of a pin from medieval times. What I care about is the disclosure on interims as well as full year of the goodwill amortization charge. I just, if you have interim disclosure, now if this comes back, the actual goodwill amortization amount should be absolutely clear in interims as well as full year statements. That's possibly for question three versus question two, but I wanted to get it in now. So thanks.
Thank you, James. It's a new perspective for us to consider, so thank you very much.
Thanks.
Deirdre, let's go to you.
Angels.
Thanks. I suppose, again, given my background, goodwill is a bit of a challenge to think about, particularly from, regulatory capital perspective, as it's disallowed. It's not perceived as being tangible and not allowed. So from a financials perspective, it's neither here nor there often. But putting a wider hat on, I suppose at the moment, the way goodwill is treated, somebody had already mentioned the word wasting asset. So it's presumed not to be a wasting asset. So it probably brings it back to the useful life discussion. if management have to disclose that, in effect, they're having to justify why it isn't a wasting asset. So that would be insightful, potentially for us in the medium term. If we think about when goodwill is impaired, again, somebody alluded to the fact it's always quite historic. The event has happened. It's a bit of a shock to the left field. So that useful life component may make that or reduce that shock element, or it just gives us potentially a little bit more of a tramline. But it is a non-cash item, so you know, from a valuation perspective, it's not going to have an influence for us. So I'm sorry, it's very mixed. I think it's along the lines with other quite conflicted. Wouldn't be a natural thought process for me, but that question as to why management believe it not to be a wasting asset is probably the first challenge, and that alludes to the useful life disclosure.
Thanks, Deirdre. Let's go to Rosemary next.
Thanks, Nick. Well, like some others, I guess I'm split as well. You know, as others have said as well, Jeremy's approach, if we could split into three parts, is probably a good way to approach this. I guess that's off the table, so it's a non-starter at this point. I think one of the considerations when looking at whether we should use the amortization or impairment model is whether one is sort of focusing on profit and loss or, you know, return of capital or invested capital. And I think that could kind of drive to different answers. But I guess, you know, where I ended up is that I think that in theory, the impairment model, you know, should be the better model if carried out as intended and management doesn't, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, manipulate the earnings. And, you know, so, you know, studies have found management is not recognizing impairment until things have gone very badly. So there is a timing issue, you know, the too little, too late issue. So that is a sort of the knock against the impairment model. But I think, if executed correctly, I think it is better than the amortization. But because of this too little, too late, I think is what leads us to the discussion of amortization. And I guess one of the key benefits of, you know, the amortization, it's of course less costly. It is consistent with the idea that goodwill is a wasting asset, as others have said. But again, on balance, I think I would tend towards the impairment model because it ultimately provides a better picture of whether an acquisition was accretive, you know, or not. And I think under the amortization approach, all acquisitions are generally treated the same. And in my opinion, you know, it doesn't give real insight into management performance and how it relates to and how it has performed with respect to a particular acquisition. So, again, as I said, I sort of tend to impairment on balance.
Okay, thanks, Rosemary. That's great. Larissa, you wanted to come back in?
Yes, thank you. Listening to the comments, three things still grate at me. The first one is a comment made in the beginning, which was that it's very difficult to estimate the useful life. I completely agree, but I don't think the fact that it's difficult means it shouldn't be done. And at some point, we need to take a call on the lesser of the evils. I can't remember who made the comment, but it was around companies don't willingly overpay. I know of many that have very willingly overpaid, but that was because they bought something other than necessarily brand. You may buy entry into a market that's difficult to get into. You may buy time when it would take too long to set up a greenfields operation. You may buy expertise, which is one that is impossible to measure. But if you buy a company for its people and the people leave, you can argue that the brand remains as long as you want. You've lost a very valuable part of the intangible. So I really like Rosemary's comment about impairment being too little too late, and then amortization. The last thing I have is a question more than a comment, and that is, I don't know if anybody has any sense of the impact of algorithmic trading and whether the algorithms ignore goodwill. So we've had several comments that investors can ignore goodwill or adjust for it in the sell side or in the analyst community. I don't know the extent to which algorithms do. And I would question that because certainly in the stocks under my coverage, I have seen volatility based on accounting anomalies over the years. It typically self-corrects relatively quickly, but I would ask that question. Thank you.
Thanks, Larissa. And that's a good point because obviously some of that quant-driven money has certainly grown in proportion. In my experience, what drives the algorithm is where they find a correlation. Until that correlation stops working, then something else drives the algorithm. So it seems to be a world that's very pragmatic in that respect. Lily, did you want to come in now?
Sure. Thank you for this. And really, really helpful discussion. Thank you, everybody, for the feedback. I go back and forth between being intellectually stimulated and just feeling sick in my stomach about how we're going to proceed with this project. I wanted to just double check my understanding to make sure I'm not reading too much into your comments. The board hasn't made any decisions about amortization versus impairment only, but if the board were to go down a path of amortization, obviously a useful life would need to be determined. And I'm just trying to think through, they could go down the direction of saying management needs to estimate their useful life or come up with a fixed useful life. The board could just say, back in the old days, 2+ decades ago, 40 years in the U.S., or, you know, whatever the number is, it could just come up with a number. And I'm hearing from some of the CMAC members that there is value in having management estimate that useful life. Coy, I think you mentioned that it kind of gives you some insight over how long it takes for management to recoup the investment. And I might be putting words into your mouth, Jeremy, but this idea of wouldn't it be ideal if we could separate out goodwill into its component parts and then amortize based off of that, that sort of implies to me that maybe a useful life estimation might provide some sort of that information through the back door. But then I'm also hearing the mixed views that maybe, you know what, it's not really that critical of information, and it's fine if we just have a fixed life and move on with it. But I want to make sure I'm not reading too much into the comments, if anyone can kind of provide some color on that.
Would other CMAC members who'd like to cut Deirdre can. Let's go to Deirdre first then, please.
Just my reaction, if you're moving to an impairment model, I don't think the benefit of having a standardized impairment time frame would be beneficial at all. I think that makes it redundant. The benefit of moving to an impairment versus impairment/amortization model would be getting that useful life and that incremental color as to why management did pay X for a company. But if it's just tram lines, you know, X type of company, you amortize it over 40 years, then that doesn't provide any benefit as far as I'd be concerned.
So I'd be interested to know if anyone disagrees with what Deirdre has just said, that actually even if it's arbitrary and that the board would set a amortization period or a maximum or something, that would still be the preferred route to go. Are we saying those who are speaking up in favour of amortisation, is it essential that the companies can estimate the useful life of the goodwill? If anyone has a different perspective on that, it would be very useful for us to hear. Jeremy, you have a comment?
Well, in the situation where we were sure that goodwill was only due to synergy, then I think the management should be allowed to set their own useful life based on the synergy estimations. If they think they're going to have post-tax synergies of 100 per year for 5 years, then you can start to align that with the amortization period.
But if the only route that we could agree on was that we'd have to set an arbitrary life for goodwill because it was too judgmental, whatever, let's say that's I'm not saying we would, does that still facilitate a use where amortization has any use, or as soon as it becomes arbitrary, does the number lose its utility?
I think it would lose its utility because it's not consistent with what's happening in the business.
Okay.
I mean, just echoing previous comments, from a practical perspective, whether it's an impairment or amortization, I think it will be added back as a non-GAAP metric by most companies, and I think I would say the majority of users would ignore either of these numbers because it's just very hard to interpret.
No, thank you. That's helpful. Joel, I haven't forgotten you. I'll come back to you in a moment, but just, Rosemary, if you have a comment on this particular issue, please go ahead.
It's
now.
It's similar to what Jeremy... Yeah, sorry, so similar to what Jeremy said, so it's fine.
Okay. No, thank you. Joel, let's hear from you then, please.
It was just a very quick comment on what Larissa mentioned. I can't put a number on the impact or make any very scientific measure of it, of algorithm trading on the back of goodwill, but it certainly plays a part, and I've done it myself. There are quite a few ways in which you can do an hour trading in which you essentially do exactly that. You try to anticipate the impairment. You look at the performance prior to that, and you look at the amount of goodwill that across the entire market, the amount of goodwill that different companies are carrying, and you start making a position for or against companies based on that. And there are definitely quant funds that do that on a regular basis.
Thanks, Joel. Tim, is there anything else that you'd like to ask on this question?
Just as a bit of a follow-up, I guess, to Nili's question as well. So we've heard from a number of people that have articulated why it could be useful information, and then in follow-up to Nili's, sort of the continuation of that, that actually management estimated amortization, you know, could provide or would provide better information certainly than an arbitrary charge. For those that haven't spoken up, and for those that were obviously against amortization as well, in terms of, and again, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm sort of reading too much into it, that I'm assuming that for those people, amortization wouldn't be useful information. I'd just be interested in perspectives for those that don't think it's useful information, whether it's because you feel that it's just not possible to estimate a useful life, and therefore you're sceptical whether management could ever provide a reasonable estimate of that, and therefore you think it will always be arbitrary, or whether actually it's a more fundamental issue that, yeah, however it's estimated, even if management can provide a reasonable estimate, however it is estimated, it's just not useful information for you for the way that you analyse companies, the way you go about it. I'd just like to get a sense of, for those that don't think it's particularly useful information, whether it's more scepticism over whether you can reliably estimate, or whether it is just a more fundamental belief that it just doesn't provide me with useful information.
Okay, so just hold on to that thought. Do you want to come at this stage, and Andreas, to build on that?
It's probably really building off that. The question that I had when we had the discussion is how much of the discussion impairment versus amortization is really driven by different perceptions of what an impairment actually constitutes. Is an impairment a reflection of a failure of the company to realize assumed benefits paid for? Or is it not really a reflection of a consumption of the benefits assumed for? And if it was the latter, then it seems to pinpoint that there is probably more similarity to an amortization model. So the question is, have we articulated clearly enough what the meaning of an impairment is? Is an impairment always to be equated with there being a failure, something that has not played out as anticipated, vis-a-vis something that has played out exactly as anticipated, but will be better reflected as being a consumption of the benefits paid for?
Thanks. Okay, so we've got comments from Philip, Anthony and James. So let's go to Philip first, if we could. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. I'm not sure I'm going to address Andreas's comment, but you know, I think from a credit perspective, trying to look at sort of future cash flows, I'm not sure that amortization provides that much information to help with that. You know, by contrast, I think impairment does, because obviously her impairment is based on a calculation based on the company's future cash flows. So any impairment that arises or doesn't arise is giving you some indication over what those cash flows are. I think it was Rosemary made the point though earlier about impairment being too little too late. I mean, often it you know, we see it happening when there's a change in management, for example. We see other circumstances which prompt an impairment, which maybe which is maybe management saying they're looking at things differently, but not necessarily prompted by changes in cash flows from the business. It's maybe by changes in the way management are looking at that. So don't know how you fix that. It's not ideal, but I'm not sure that amortization is an improvement.
Thanks, Philip. Anthony, over to you.
There we go. Now I'm unmuted. So, to the point about the life, useful life, I think it would always end up being arbitrary or to the max. And here's why. If you ask an entrepreneur when they start a business and you said, "Madam, sir, how long do you think your business will last?" None of them will tell you 5 years, 10 years. They start the business for it to endure. And so if that's the case, when I make an acquisition and the acquisition, the part of the acquisition I'm buying is that I don't know what, that je ne sais quoi, if you've got some French people around. So then how do you value that? And so you say, well, it's going to, that I bought the brand. I bought something that's going to endure. If you give me 40 years, I'll take 40. You give me 20, I'll take 20. I'm not going to bet against myself and say five. There's my answer.
Thank you, Anthony. Bertrand Perron, our French board member, appreciates your comments on many levels. I think.
Je peux parler français.
Avec grand plaisir.
Thank you. James,
let's go to you. Hello. Alors, c'est avec moins de couleurs.
Just showing off now. Come on.
Right. So, actually, I cannot. I agree with everything Anthony said. But I can't be as interestingly colorful as him. But what I will say is to Andreas as well. Address Andreas's point here too. I think having goodwill as something on the balance sheet and knowing that there's been a reason for an impairment is important information to us about investors. Possibly about management change, yes, but that has more value than either a linear or declining balance amortization schedule for us as investors. I think that's quite important from that point of view. But I will also like to then echo what one of the things that Koei said, which was we should always have available the accumulated amortization that has taken place. And I think in that regard, that is very important. So coming from an anti-amortization point of view, those are my points.
Thank you, James. Bertrand, let's go to you.
Yes, first, thank you, Anthony and James, for your French comments. I appreciate it. I will try to answer to some issue with regard to the impairment and amortization. I think impairment is not devoted to consume the assets. Assets is consumed through amortization, as it is for, I would say, for fixed assets that you buy and that you consume over 5, 10, 20 years. I don't know, it depends on the assets. So this is the main issue, is that to differentiate the amortization and impairment. And we have the issue with impairment we discussed, with that it's very difficult to put in place an impairment. It's impairment is that the asset has lost value because of, for example, from external factors. With regard to the length of the useful life of the goodwill and the amortization, subsequent amortization, if this is the choice, what is retained, I think, of course, I would respond to Anthony is that, of course, you expect that you will use the company forever, but a goodwill, you don't expect, you, I would say that there may be some safeguards. And if someone is going to sell the company and sell, well, you will pay a lot because you expect to use it for 200 years, you will not consider buying the company. That it may be true. So at the end, there is a balance to be done, and a reasonable balance or some safeguards, so that to estimate in a proper manner the useful life of the goodwill. Because I don't expect a buyer to buy more. You can have some buyers that buy for very long, but at the end, there may be some safeguards, and you can look at what is doing the competition and so on. So there may be some safeguards about the length of the useful life of the good.
Thank you, Bertrand. Tim, are we exhausted question two?
I think so.
Okay. Thank you. apart from a short comment from Matthias. Matthias, over to you.
Yeah, sorry, very, very quickly. Just want to remind that in this whole discussion, we should not forget that we usually do not test goodwill for impairment, but we test CGUs and then draw conclusions on whether goodwill is impaired. And there are, this is not a topic here of this discussion, but there are lots of games companies can play reintegrating an entity into another bigger CGU, which has a lot of headroom until it an impairment is triggered, to avoid such impairments. And this is also something to keep in mind, which is rather an argument in favor of amortization.
Thanks, Matthias. With that, shall we move on to the... Rika.
Yes.
Rika, over to you.
Can I just confirm one thing about probably I echo something Koe had already mentioned? Because suppose we implemented both amortization and impairment test model. In that case, the estimate of goodwill, life of goodwill, would be the significant estimate for management. So that means the management would be required to disclose the information about how to determine the life of goodwill. I just wondering, would that information be additional value for you or not?
Okay. So to rather than simply have a disclosure about the number, but the process, the thinking that went behind reaching that number, whether that qualitative disclosure actually would add further value. Any thoughts on Rika's question there from CMAT members? So Deirdre has put in the chat, yes, that would certainly add value from her perspective, as has Rosemary. Do either of you want to speak to that?
Sorry, I can speak just very briefly. I suppose that would be the benefit as far as we were concerned if you were going down the useful life path. Sorry, I may not have been clear in my wandering comments earlier. The number in itself is not necessarily beneficial. The thought process behind the determination of that number is what would be useful for us. I know it's all subjective and we're constantly given numbers and it's all always subjective, but if this is the path you're going down, then it is the incremental information that determines that useful knife that's of benefit to us.
Thanks, Deirdre. Thank you. Tim, we will then move on to the third question.
Okay. So, another topic associated with amortization of goodwill that we'd like CMAC members' views on is convergence. Although there are some differences in the details of the models applied, both IFRS standards and US GAAP require an impairment-only model to be used to account for goodwill. The FASB also have a project on their agenda considering goodwill and have tentatively decided to reintroduce amortization of goodwill. And the questions for CMAC members on this topic are on slide 19 and will help the board understand how investors would compare companies that account under the different models and whether the information to make those comparisons is available or whether additional information is needed. And also some idea of the cost of having to perform those types of comparisons. So again, I'd like to open the floor up for CMAC members to discuss.
Thanks, Tim. So this is a scenario, let's call it, where we have two different models, one which is amortization and impairment, and one which is impairment only.
Yep.
How would the world, or users in particular, manage that and additional information that would be required under that scenario?
Yes.
Okay, that's very clear. Thank you. So Anthony's already touched on this subject. I'm happy to hear from him again if there's any additional information that would help. But before we do that, Matthias, I think, has a question of clarification.
Yeah, just a question. If the FASB thinks about reintroducing amortization, would they do it backward looking? I mean, for transactions that have been taking place, 10, 15 years in the past. And I mean, I know we did some analysis already on this, and we know that a lot of companies would end up with a negative equity if we go back, let's say 15 years amortization period and apply backward looking. But just a question, whether you have some information on this.
So am I right to think that hasn't been addressed yet?
No, they haven't got round to thinking about how they would do transition.
So that's on the to-do list for them. But it's a pertinent question. But Matthias, perhaps we could stick with you. You've been an advocate of a amortization and impairment model. We've heard that from you today. Although you also said that you're a little bit on the fence with this. Is this something that you could manage if we operated in a world with different models, and what information would you need to help you operate in that world?
What do you mean exactly? So,
let's say that under US GAAP we had the US GAAP did decide to pursue the tentative view of going down an amortization and impairment model. And for IFRS, we didn't.
I think we could work with it. Would not be ideal, of course. It has been mentioned a couple of times before. If we get more information, we could also recalculate many things. We do not need perhaps an amortization ourselves, but we could do it our own. And so we could also make FASB or US GAAP and IFRS comparable. But of course, from an optical point of view, this would not be a great thing if ISB and FASB go different ways here. But it would be manageable, I think.
Andreas, do you want to come in?
Thank you. Just asking a question to Matthias here. Do you think that would also be the case on a continuous basis? So not just looking at this year's period, where obviously you can reconstruct by just backing out the number that has been booked on one side but not on the other, but can you do that for successive periods? So if you think about a 10-year time comparison, do you think it would be feasible to reconstruct the numbers of the other side? Because that would be, I think, quite an important argument in favor of, well, convergence, nice to have, but not a must have, because if there was a way to reconstruct, then obviously it would be highly informative for the board.
Yeah, I think with the current set of information would be difficult, but perhaps with more information would work. But you're right, it's not getting any easier over time. That's true.
Thanks, Matthias. Let's hear from Deirdre next.
I think all of my comments have actually just been addressed there now. So firstly, ideally, the two wouldn't diverge. We could manage if they diverged, but we would probably make adjustments to, I'm guessing the amortizing model might be easier for peer comp purposes globally. Now, it wouldn't affect our valuation because it's a non-cash item. But ironically, the last comment that I had was specifically about the passage of time and whether or not we would have sufficient disclosure as that time passed to do the reconciliation between amortizing goodwill and identifying that goodwill that would have been subject to the impairment test historically. So that would, with the passage of time, I would see that as a big hurdle. And then that peer comp from a global perspective would become a challenge. But, you know, it doesn't affect our DCF valuation.
Thank you. Thanks, Deirdre. It's very clear. Jeremy.
I think in the scenario outlined, the main helpful point would be in the cash flow statement to disaggregate depreciation and amortization. Because sometimes it's given as a single number, which includes owned assets, right of use assets, impairment, and so forth. If that could be split out, including if there would be this new amortization of goodwill, that would be very helpful. So I know, I suppose connected to that would be the amortization of intangibles, as acquired intangibles as well, in the cash flow statement, especially when you're dealing with lots of companies. To get this information digitally tagged in the cash flow statement is much more helpful than having it in the notes to one of the fixed asset tables. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy. Go to Anthony next.
Thanks, Nick. But I'm not sure I still understand, or I yet understand what FASB's thinking and why they want to. Yeah, are you teasing me, telling me you want to get them on the phone? That's the only way.
Well, we can't answer for FASB, and they've had, you know, some lengthy discussions. This their decision at the moment is still tentative. They have been most recently investigating issues around how you determine useful life and what information that may convey to investors. So that's where they're up to. At the moment,
they went with a default period, and they're looking at factors that companies might use to rebut that default period or move away from that default period.
I guess I'll do some digging here and see what I can find. I just wonder if the groundswell of desire for amortization is coming from users or preparers. So your comment is you wanted to know about my problem with convergence. I think convergence is very important for this because of the scale of the this, you know, the amount of acquisitions that are taking place. The number is continues to escalate as growth gets fueled largely from acquisition. And so comparability across companies is critical. I think that I'll make a projection. If we go to no amortization and they go to amortization, all that's going to happen is the U.S. companies will just eliminate the amortization when they present their numbers in their adjusted numbers, and as will the analysts. And it'd be interesting to see if companies, because they can list in the U.S. under the SEC and use IFRS without reconciliation, maybe more companies will choose to go to IFRS. I mean, I want to write that down. I'll take that bet.
We'll make a note of the date.
Yep.
Thank you, Anthony. Larissa.
That's really funny. Okay, so to answer the question, I think ideally we should...
You're on a comedy show, too.
Well, look, to be honest, if they keep it different, they'll keep everybody in this room employed for a long time because we'll spend half our days adjusting for Goodwill. I just think there are more interesting things to adjust for. So to answer the question, I think it is ideal to align, especially when you get to the multinationals that report in multiple jurisdictions, specifically if you have a New York and a London Stock Exchange listing, for example. Two other things. Somebody made a comment about if companies had to amortize, they'd be bankrupt, which to me, surely, if they were going to be bankrupt, if they amortized, they wouldn't pass the impairment test, I would think, which actually brings me to the point that I want to make, and that is that was around the transition. I thought that was a really interesting question. The thing is, if a company can't tell you what its goodwill consists of and when that goodwill was created, I dare say we have a much bigger problem at hand. I do think that it's very easy. Somebody mentioned that you just add it to a business unit that has headroom. We know about that. You can actually make cash a permanent intangible, although I can't imagine why I'd want to do that. Just overpay for an asset and stick it on your balance sheet for eternity. But if it's too old to properly assess, I would say there is a bigger problem at hand. And that gets into the very tricky topic of how do auditors verify goodwill? Because to be honest, I think the auditing profession is in a very tricky position there because it is subjective and it's very difficult to argue with a management team. So at least if you impair in however bad a metric, or amortize, if you amortize over time, it makes the problem go away over time. I can't say that. I sit here and I keep thinking that 10 years ago I had a Nokia phone and it was all the rage. And 20 years ago, everybody had Kodak, and Kodak decided not to go digital. So I'm not convinced that we're talking about assessing a 50 or 100-year amortization period. My gut feel would say we're talking between 5 and 20 years. And that is relevant to earnings.
Thanks, Larissa. Anne, did you want to make a comment at this stage?
Thanks, Nick. So I'd just like to ask about these two models. So people have said maybe the adjustment would be to take out the amortization and impairment if that was, let's say, that was the FASB model where that had been reintroduced. And as I understand it, lots of analysts would be doing that anyway. Compare that to an IFRS model, let's say, that was impairment only. So two things. One, how would analysts approach the fact that you get different information under each model? Because some of you have said today that having the impairment charge actually gives information. So that was my first part. And then secondly, just to pick up on what information would analysts need to be able to do that adjustment between the two models? Are you currently getting enough information to make that adjustment, or would there need to be something else provided? Larissa's already going no. Would there have to be, what is it that will need to be provided if the boards have different models?
So Larissa, why you've got the floor, why don't you respond to Anne's question?
Well, it's hypothetical at this point, but if the US were to go with an amortization period and the Europe didn't, and you want to normalize, or IFRS didn't, you want to normalize IFRS to US GAAP, you would need an amortization period or an indication of that. Otherwise, you're going to make an assumption. And in my experience, analysts tend to err to the side of the conservative, which may be to the detriment of the companies. Or if it's going to go the US way, we would need what was commented previously, that you would need to know exactly how much has been amortized and how much had earnings every year, and also very specifically where it's reported. Because in a world where a lot of the headline earnings number that companies report is an adjusted IFRS number, it adds a layer of complexity that I think may just be... I don't think it's impossible to navigate. I think it makes it cumbersome.
Thanks, Larissa. Well, let's go to Coy and then to James. But Coy first.
Thank you. In Japan, goodwill is amortized under JGAAP. So we already perform analysis between their differing treatments. In practice, I think that many analysts use profit before amortization of goodwill, while also taking into account impairment risk. Because the adjustment is very simple. I think that a variation of corporate value based on profit before goodwill amortization end up being inflated due to the incompleteness of impairment test. While inflated variation may not be an issue in times of normalcy, investors end up sharing massive risk in times of earnings deterioration. I believe this contributes to the criticism of impairment tests as too late. I think it is meaningful to amortize goodwill from perspective of making up for the incompleteness of impairment tests as well. That's all.
Thanks, Koi. James.
Yes, I'm trying to kind of answer the question here that Anna just posed as well in doing this. So, I mean, I think the only viable time series comparison and cross-border or cross-accounting system comparison is on measures based on tangible equity, ROTE, etc. And that also, from the top line, that clearly has to deduct amortize or add back amortization of goodwill. So I'm not sure it's going to be that big an issue, because in reality, that's the only comparison, the kind of comparisons you can make anyway. So it seems to me backdating would be a hell of a lot of work. But I think, you know, I'll repeat what I said before. You need it for interims. You need this goodwill amortization in the period in the interims, and you need the cumulative impairment and cumulative amortization figures there. So you can have maybe another measure, the CROCI, cash return on capital invested. That might be quite a useful comparison to make as analysts as well. But so those are my comments. That's it.
Thanks, James.
Bertrand?
Yes, a short comment. The question is difficult because we don't know currently what will be the choice.
Bertrand, would you mind just seeing if you can move your mic, because you're quite quiet at this end. I don't know if you.
I have a problem with my battery. I have just to fix it, or maybe I can call. I can, if someone is doing some comments, give me 2 minutes.
You carry on. Carry on. Just perhaps speak louder.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. Just, we don't know currently what will be the choice or the decision of the FASB and the IASB. So the comparison between what we will do from one to the other is, do we have to adjust the US numbers, or do you have to adjust the IASB numbers? So that's an issue. But nevertheless, whatever the outcome, I agree with James that we need information about the goodwill for any decisions. That means that we need to understand for how long there is the goodwill, where this goodwill come from, and for each goodwill, for how long it is amortized or not. But we need such some information. And what as expect is that the ASB will make the good decision, but it's to you, I would say. But you know that we need information, whatever the decision, we need information about the consistency, about the value of goodwill, and for how long it is, to which company it relates to, and so on and so on. So more information that we currently have.
Thanks, Bertrand. And Anthony's added a message into the chat that reflecting that certainly under Japanese GAAP, companies amortize their goodwill, and whether we should have a study of the analyst community in terms of how they deal with those numbers, whether or not, in essence, they add them back to their to the reported numbers to facilitate comparison with global peers. I'm aware that there have been, I'm not sure it's on that precise question, but there certainly have been some questions already or studies already undertaken with analysts based in Japan. Philip, you, oh, Craig, sorry, Tim, rather. Well, did you want to come in?
Well, it was just a follow-up question, I guess, to a point that Bertrand made, because some people around the table have been saying that we would need to know the amortization charge, the goodwill amortization charge, and be very clear what that was. Bertrand went a little bit further, I think, and it'll be interesting to hear other members' views on it as to whether, and it depends on what the board's decisions were and what, you know, what the model was, but if there were different amortization periods for different acquisitions, whether you would need to know that amortization charge by acquisition, as it were, or would the overall number be sufficient?
Well, let's see. We're close to time, actually. We're just about on time. But if anyone has any views on that immediately or later, please filter them through to us. But Philip, you had a comment?
Yeah, I suppose just jumping back to the last discussion, you know, Anne mentioned about the information content of an impairment. I think it was sort of me that brought that up. And, you know, how do you cope if you lose that? And, you know, I think Japan's one example where you have an amortization model. I mean, it's something we cope with at the moment. And, you lose that information content that you have from the impairment. But, you know, I'd prefer that was there for one set of GAAP rather than neither set of GAAP. So, you know, while consistency is great, you know, there's reasons for us not to have that in certain circumstances as well. If we think there's a better solution, you know, it's there can be a better solution than consistency. So I'd just urge you to keep that in mind as well.
And I think the question that Tim just asked about whether it's you want the average life across all acquisitions or whether you need it by acquisition for goodwill is a useful one. And certainly if CMAC members have thoughts on that, please let us know. That would be very helpful. Tim, is there anything further that you want to...
I think the general message I got was that for most it is something that users are able to cope with, and there's obviously some good experience in Japan as well where that has, you know, that already happens. So it sounds like users can cope with it, but for most they would prefer not to have to cope with it, type thing. But then there is some consideration about some additional information is needed in circumstances to allow or to at least aid that approach.
Great. And just in response to your specific question, Rosemary, Larissa and Deirdre concur that it would actually be the estimated life by acquisition that would be most useful. So I think that's going to close our session on goodwill and related issues. We will take a short break now. If we could come back at 1:40 London time, so beyond 5 minutes that's in the schedule. So a very quick break, and we'll see you all back at 1:40 London time. Thank you.